Hey guys, my name is Peter Sohn, and you guys are listening to the Pixar Podcast.
To infinity and beyond!
So, how long is this going to take?
Squirrel!
You can't rush art.
I never look back, darling. It distracts from the now.
What's the point of going out there? They'll only laugh at me.
Stranger, from the outside.
Greetings.
Hello there, Pixar fans. Welcome again to another episode of the Pixar Podcast. This is episode number 138. ThePixarPodcast.com/138 is where you can find show notes for this episode. I'm Derek Clements. And on today's podcast episode, a conversation with Pixar veteran Sharon Callahan. A few years ago, Sharon Callahan became a member of the American Society of Cinematographers, and she was actually the society's first member to have a reel made entirely of CG footage. She has a background in illustration and design, and she's worked in the animation business, and specifically at Pixar, for decades. She's mostly been a lighting supervisor, director of photography, and her passion for capturing natural beauty played a big role in creating the painterly realistic world of The Good Dinosaur back in 2015. She also has a long academic paper that I'll link to in the show notes. It's called Storytelling Through Lighting, a Computer Graphics Perspective. She does a lot of plein air landscapes, oil paintings. She spends a lot of her time outdoors, capturing what she sees with her paintbrush. When we spoke, we talked about her role on The Good Dinosaur, and we started the conversation talking about our favorite places. So I am from Utah. I come from Utah. So I love, you know, the Rocky.
Sick?
What's that?
Are you homesick?
In watching the film? Yes. No, I love it. I've grown to just love the Rocky Mountains and everything. And wow, they're right there in the film, in The Good Dinosaur. And also, of course, like, you're from the Pacific Northwest.
Yes, I'm from Washington State originally and spent a lot of time in British Columbia and Montana and spent a lot of time painting in Wyoming.
Yeah. So this summer I actually just did a road trip going to Vancouver and then kind of down the Pacific.
I live in Vancouver.
Okay. Yeah. Gorgeous part of the world. I wonder if you just talk about that place and kind of your feelings about that particular place, because I think that they bleed into the film. I think that they're present.
Oh, good. Well, Pete was originally looking for a place to set the film that where he could have a hard scrabble, you know, tough environment for a pioneering farm family to live in, and he wanted this flat farmland with this mountain that rose straight out of the ground with a big river nearby, and I'm like, oh, I know exactly where that is. Yeah. Let's go visit the Jackson area, and he fell in love with it, and so it became the setting in the film.
Yeah. How long have you lived here in the Bay Area?
About 25 years now, I think.
Is the Pacific Northwest still home?
Oh, yes, very definitely. My family's still up there, and I try to get up there as often as I can.
Yeah. You said that you're the happiest when you're painting in the wilderness.
That's true.
Talk about that. What does that feel like?
Well, it varies widely depending upon what's going on around me. Sometimes it can be extremely frightening. Sometimes it can be cold. One of my favorite things is to go out and paint in the snow. And so I'm very comfortable being out in 20-degree weather painting. I discovered over this last Christmas that anything below about 10 degrees doesn't work very well for the paint.
Yeah. Wait, you would be there in the 10-degree weather trying to paint?
I was painting at 0 degrees this last winter, and I was perfectly warm and toasty, but my paint wouldn't come off the brush because it was freezing on my brush.
Wow, so to be a great artist, you need a paintbrush, you need all these art supplies, you need a jacket, you need a...
and heaters in your boots.
Wow. So I guess how do you capture that feeling? You mentioned, like, capturing the cold on the paper and the temperature. Is it... And I don't have any sort of visual background. So is it a color thing? I mean, how do you capture a temperature and a feeling on a painting?
Well, if you've got you know, the value relationships and color relationships, you know, true to what you're seeing at that particular moment, the memories come flooding back later. It's like when I do a small sketch on location and somebody wants to buy it, I don't want to sell them, and I almost never do, because for me, they're more memories on canvas than they are, you know, actual paintings.
Yeah.
So do you have the same experience when you're seeing other people's work? Does it recall memories of that particular place, or, you know, does it have to be something that you painted for that to sort of have that effect on you?
No, a lot of times if it's something I'm familiar with, it'll evoke the same memories. And I think that's why people like buying art from places they've been before or they know well, because it does evoke those strong memories in them in a way that, you know, maybe a photograph doesn't.
Yeah. Well, talk about your role here at Pixar, because I was looking at your credits and you're in a lot of credits. You've done a lot of work, but you're also in a lot of the thanks, special thanks or things like that. What would you say is your role here at Pixar?
Well, I'm kind of one of the fossils. I've been here for a long time now, over 21 years, and I do consult on a lot of projects. I love helping, you know, people who are up and coming, you know, reach the next level and feel supported. So I kind of spread out a bit.
I think it was, the Toy Story that Time Forgot is the very special thanks that you got for that one. What did you do on that film?
I think I was mostly consulting, you know, for, you know, light and color and just helping shepherd the process through.
Yeah. Okay. Well, talk about The Good Dinosaur. So let's talk about how would you characterize the visual style of this film? You called it painterly, and I think that's definitely a word I would use too. But how would you characterize what does this film look like?
Well, I like to call it kind of painterly real, in that I was trying for a look that, you know, was very immersive and authentic to a location where you could feel like you were actually there, you know, not necessarily real, but as John Lasseter would call it, kind of a heightened realism, or a better than real is what he would say. And, you know, and I wanted it to like, there's a difference between how a camera captures something with its dynamic range and how your eye sees things. And I wanted to impart enough of how your eye sees the world combined with how the camera sees the world into something that feels a little different than we've done before.
Well, so you've been at Pixar for 20 years?
21 years.
21 years. How have you seen it overcome challenges as any company is, you know, growing and becoming this amazing organization? How have you seen Pixar grow and change over the years?
Well, it's definitely gotten a lot bigger since I joined the company, but I think the core of the company feels very much the same to me. Like, you know, what they're trying to do, what they're passionate about, I think that's kind of been the through line and what's gotten us through those big challenges that happen when a company tries to grow and take on more challenges. There's always bumps in the road, but I think because the core principles and keeping everybody focused on creating great art, you know, has helped us really grow beyond anything that's happened.
Yeah. I'm always amazed at how many different types of artists there are here and how they all kind of do their own style, but it all fits together in this thing.
Yeah, it's a pretty special place that way, and there's always somebody to learn from. That's one of the amazing things about this company is that everybody here is really great at what they do and loves to share it.
Yeah. What's your favorite memory, whether it was, you know, just a happy memory or overcoming a challenge working on The Good Dinosaur?
Wow, that's a tough one. I think that I'm really proud of how the team came together and really made the film happen at a time when it seemed pretty daunting, you know, like it was an ambitious challenge, you know, we weren't really sure we could pull it off in the time that we had, and just how everybody got behind the film and really rallied, it was pretty incredible.
At what point in the process did the data from the government company?
USGS data?
Yes, USGS. At what point did you guys find that landmine? Or that, not landmine, but like gold mine.
That was pretty early on, because we needed to kind of figure out, well, how do we extend the world in a way that wasn't going to, you know, break us, you know, because we didn't have time to design and build geometry for all of that, and to have that kind of variety of terrain, you know. And it was actually Sanjay Bakshi's idea to explore that, and it was like once he hit upon it, it's like, oh, okay, thank goodness we know what we're going to do now.
Does that kind of give you the courage to be able to, like, hey, we can make sets that are 100 miles big and stuff like that?
Yeah, and the nice thing was is we could customize it when we needed to, you know. Like, if the terrain didn't do exactly what we wanted, you know, we could push and pull points all around on the surface to turn it into what we needed.
Yeah, that's so great. Okay, this is maybe a big question, but we don't have a lot of time. So how would you answer this? How do you balance visual information? Maybe it's not a big question, I don't know. But when you're creating an image, you have to balance information, like what's happening in the story, with what you say, the visual poetry of it. How do you balance those two things?
Well, that is a good question. I think you go with your gut, you know? You kind of have to, because if you try to intellectualize it too much, you're going to err too much on one side or another. At least, I mean, that's how I work. You know, I take my best shot at it, and then I go with my gut as to whether or not it's working.
Okay. Well, it's so wonderful to meet you, and congratulations on all your work.
Thank you.
Okay. You're listening to the Pixar Podcast. That was my conversation with Sharon Callahan. And now I'm going to play for you a presentation she gave to a large group of journalists on the same day that I spoke to her. She told a lot of stories about research trips for The Good Dinosaur and how they created that painterly look. Here it is.
When Pete and I first started talking about the films that were, and the kind of film that we wanted to make, we started talking about the films that were memorable to us, both as kids and as adults. But a lot of the ones like that kind of lingered in our minds over the years is like, yeah, I'd like to make a film like that. And so the ones that really stood out to us were the ones that were full of heart and that were also really rich in visual storytelling. The Black Stallion, especially the first act, was particularly inspiring. There was a lot of really strong emotions like loss and isolation and the struggle for survival, altruism and friendship, and they were all just gorgeously narrated with just imagery. You know, there wasn't a lot of dialogue, so it inspired us to be daring to minimize the dialogue and really visually show the connection between the characters. Another Carol Ballard film that was also really important to us was Never Cry Wolf. A lot of, because of the vast feeling of the landscapes, was a really key part in making the characters feel vulnerable and small in this really big world. The scenes where the researcher has these close encounters with the wolf and some of the other animals, too, were really helpful for the animators as well to kind of figure out how to set up those relationships. And there were other films that were inspirational for scope and scale, such as 7 Years in Tibet. Pete really wanted it to be a journey of great physical distance as well as a journey of emotional growth. And I watched every Frontier Western film I could get my hands on. And this was one that really stood out to me. I hadn't heard of it before. It was called Seraphim Falls. And it was just this beautiful film with two characters following each other on this journey through a wilderness. So it seemed kind of perfect for us. Excuse me. I also watched any film I could find that was shot in the Rocky Mountain West. So Heaven's Gate was one that immediately came to my mind to rewatch. It was just really gorgeous, both for lighting, but also for compositions. Dances with Wolves was another standout that we referenced often, especially for like the Bisodon crowd scenes and stuff. Just looking for a water. Pete really wanted the setting to inform and become an integral part of the story, so finding the right location was really crucial. And he wanted that pioneering homesteading life, but he didn't want it to be easy. He wanted it to be this hard scrabble existence where, you know, the whether or not the farm was successful was kind of always in question. So another reason why this area in Wyoming was kind of like the perfect fit is because you can see the soil is really rocky. You know, it's really hard to grow anything there. The growing season's very short. You know, you have maybe a couple of months to grow something out of the year. They had to clear out a lot of brush and stuff to you know, and you could even see from the times when the Mormon settlers were there of where they cleared the land. You know, there was that mark of history still there. And it really helped, like Pete mentioned last night, that Shane was a nostalgic favorite for him.
We even had to go visit the actual cabin where that movie was shot. And the scouting trip was designed to, you know, get Pete the city boy as immersed as possible into a rural area. And he's probably the most curious person I've ever met in my life. He asks thousands of questions. It can be exhausting to spend very much time with him. He likes to drill deep down into every little thing. Like, he's completely unashamed to ask questions that, you know, you might go, oh, that's kind of obvious, because he wants to understand stuff at the deepest level. And it is all informed the story. Like, there's always a purpose for him drilling down into those questions. And he remembers everything. And he's excited and enthusiastic about everything he sees. So it's really infectious. And so we took the drift boat trips down the Snake. It was just gorgeous autumn weather. We had a little bit of remnants of the fall color. It was just such an incredible way to spend the day. The boat trip was run by a fishing guide company who, they really couldn't understand why we weren't fishing. It's like, here you have this beautiful day, you've got these boats, why aren't you fishing? What is it that you do? So anytime we stopped for any brief period of time, they had their rods out and were telling us all about, you know, the cutthroat and the other fish that were currently in the river. Our second excursion was the trail ride into the Targhee Wilderness area on the Idaho side of the Tetons. And it was, again, just, we couldn't have had more beautiful weather when we were there. It was just absolutely glorious. We did get to see some moose on the way up, which was kind of fun. Much better than running into grizzly bears. And it was, got pretty snowy towards the higher elevations, quite a bit of ice. The horses were slipping a bit on the rocks. And each of the horses had a very distinct personality and had the feisty horse. And Sanjay's horse was always losing its footing. Even if there wasn't any ice, it kept falling in front of me. Mary Alice's horse liked to bite the horse in front of her, which was usually mine. So my horse was always, like, jumping out from under me. And I don't know how Mary Alice was able to do it, but she was able to get usable footage from the back of a horse. It's like I was even trying to take still photos, and mine were just a smeary mess. And I don't think I've ever seen Denise smile so much. She looked like this all day long, no matter how sore the rest of us got. And this little pretty Appaloosa was my ride. And Pete was in heaven. He was like a little kid. He never wanted to stop, and he kept asking, you know, well but can't we just go around the next corner? Can't we just go over the next hill? Because what he really wanted and had in his mind was thinking that he could get to the top of the ridge and see the valley on the other side, but not realizing how much more of a distance that would take. And the only thing that got him to turn around is it was starting to get dark and everybody was really getting hungry. But it was really fun to see him experience the world for the first time and just how in awe he was of everything. You know, I mean, I grew up in a rural area, so for me, I kind of take it for granted. And so seeing it through his eyes for the first time kind of made it special all over again, like how far you can see because the air is so clear, you know, how the weather changes and how much you feel it, how, you know, like the Milky Way, just how vast everything felt. And so we talked a lot on this trip about how the settings and how the weather could influence the characters in the film and become part of the story. And we realized pretty quickly on this trip that we needed to really rethink how we did our set extensions to create, you know, sets to infinity, and how we created our skies. And I know you guys have probably already had some more in-depth presentations on that today. So, and then this was the second research trip where Pete really felt like a fish out of water, getting all of the instructions from the trail bosses that sound like gibberish. And then the third research trip where we spent in the Jackson Valley and also into Yellowstone National Park. We revisited a lot of the same locations, but we spent most of the time in Yellowstone on this one. For one of the days, we hired a van with tour guides to show us around and to answer questions about the area, mostly about geology and flora and fauna, because we were really trying to understand like how things were constructed and what kind of trees naturally grow there so that we had some sort of authenticity to it. But it was really perplexing to them because they were accustomed to people who were focused on searching out grizzly bears and shooting photos of them instead of looking at lichen on rocks and tree bark, you know, so they thought we were a little weird. We did see a lot of wildlife, foxes and moose and grizzlies, bison, elk, pronghorn, bighorn sheep, eagles, and lots of deer. So if you've never been that area, you should go. It's just totally amazing. The guides were used to all, you know, when they have a tour group, you know, the van would stop and then everybody gets out all politely and patiently waits for them to kind of interpret what you're seeing, you know. But instead, we were just like shooting out like shotgun blast of running in all different directions to shoot what we wanted, we were interested in. So they thought we were just, they didn't know what to do with us. But we did ask a lot of questions when we were in the van traveling about things. And we asked a lot of questions they didn't know how to answer, you know, because they weren't used to getting them. And we had a lot of questions about how the geothermic features work and why they change year to year. And they didn't really know, so they just kind of kept saying, well, it's kind of a mystery that, you know, is constantly changing. They kept calling, saying something about the plumbing. So it became a running joke for us where anytime we didn't understand something or something went wrong, it was all about the plumbing. Why was our flight delayed? Well, it must have been the plumbing. In addition to research, another important part of my process, especially for this film, is painting on location. I'm the happiest when I'm outdoors painting somewhere in the wilderness. I'm not necessarily trying to create finished paintings. They're mostly just quick sketches that I use as an exercise in seeing light and color and how it's changing over distance, how it's changing because of weather or time of day. And it helps create strong memories for a place of like sounds and smells and other sensations, like, you know, how hot or cold I was, you know, what was the wind doing. And it helps become this memory for later. If I'm looking at an image, I'll know if it feels right for that time of day because I've been there and witnessed it, and it'll ring true based on personal experience. In the early stages of production, even before our initial scouting trip, we started exploring what the world could possibly look like. And Pete wanted a world that would feel familiar and timeless, that the audience could relate to, almost like it could happen now rather than creating a fantasy world from some made-up Jurassic era. He wanted it to feel, you know, authentic to a specific location. So Pete really wanted to create a world that would draw the viewer into the scene like they were really there and could breathe the air. And he wanted it to have a truth and a sincerity to it. He asked me to paint up some iconic landmarks from the greater Wyoming area, which included, you know, northern Utah and eastern Idaho, northern Montana, that would help inspire the story artist for kind of possible location settings and for general kind of look and feel. He wanted a variety of terrain, you know, and feeling of scope. The only really pointy, rocky mountaintop with snow on them that he wanted to see was the home Clawtooth Mountain Range. He wanted it to be this very specific, iconic, memorable place in the film that would everything be a compass point for everything else. And some of the things that I painted weren't necessarily iconic, but typical scenes like cottonwoods along the river, of just things that I remembered from being there. This was one of the rare times I broke out actual oil paint and canvas instead of using Photoshop. And these weren't necessarily intended to be used in the film, but just simply as natural beauty to serve as inspiration. And they were, you know, they were a lot of fun for me to paint. I feel like I'm just kind of playing all the time when I'm doing these. Sometimes they were for exploring time of day looks or possible settings for a scene or for mood or to show moments of the characters just kind of romping around and playing in the world. You know, for scale reference. Some images were just exploration for scope. You know, Pete often talked about wanting to capture that big sky feeling of the West and, you know, that feeling of seeing forever. So, you know, I'd paint up ideas of, you know, possible locations of what that could look like. And one of the aspects of the Carol Ballard films that really inspired us was the use of just quiet, beautiful shots that serve as bridges between scenes or to emotionally illustrate a character's thoughts at that point in time. And we call them haiku shots because that's what Andrew Stanton called them on Finding Nemo, as brief little moments of visual poetry. After enough exploration and as production starts, you know, nearing starting point, we needed to make decisions about, you know, really what do we want the film to look like. And, you know, we're often asked, you know, why we put highly stylized characters in a more realistic world, and a lot of people call it photorealistic. And a lot of that was very deliberate, you know, not 100% of it is deliberate, because your resulting style is often influenced by, you know, external things like schedule and technology limitations that end up becoming kind of part of what the finished style is. But the characters were designed to be as appealing as possible. You know, Pete didn't want overly realistic-looking characters. But he wanted a world that was full of peril and wonder and scale, and for it to be authentic, immersive, visually rich, and believable. And so he knew what he wanted on the other side. And when you're dealing with elements like water and stuff, it's like you got to get it to a certain level of reality before you kind of, it feels right, you know. And so once you kind of start putting stakes in the ground on some things, everything else kind of needs to go with it stylistically. And also it was just really handy that, you know, with a world that had more detail in it, the characters really pop in that environment. And to me, it looks exactly the way I was hoping it would. Pete really wanted the viewer to feel like they had stepped into something that could really exist, and that the dangers would have this visceral impact when you watch it, that, you know, the water is cold, and that the rock Arlo falls on is hard, and that the vertical drop is dizzying, and especially that the wilderness feel genuinely frightening to Arlo. We knew from the outset that we'd have three big challenges. We needed to think differently about how we created the scope of the world so that we could freely move the camera in it. And we knew we'd have dramatic weather elements, and we knew that the river would be prominently featured in a large number of shots. We've done films before where we've had rivers, but not at the scope that we were going to have to do. We didn't have a lot of time to do tests, so we kept them pretty minimal. In the past, we would design and build a foreground set and use matte painting and matte painted clouds to extend the world, but the process would have been too time consuming to do that many shots on this film. So as you've probably already seen, we decided to use U.S. Geological Survey data as a, you know, underpinning, a framework to then put procedural curve data on top to extend our world to infinity. And we also decided to use volumetric clouds rather than matte painted clouds, so that everything would feel like it, you know, went together, that the clouds were getting the same light as the set, and they could cast shadows and feel like they were part of the world. The film is, this particular film is very emotional, and the job of the color script is to serve as a guide to supporting the motion in a visual way. And the process of creating it evolves as the story changes, and more ideas get thrown away than what actually makes it into the film. The process usually starts with establishing the emotional highs and lows and the big turning points, what we call kind of the tentpole moments of the film. You know, I try to see how far I can push them emotionally, because they kind of become the outer limits, and everything else kind of is relative to them and fit in between. And each moment needs to relate to the other moments. When I'm thinking about a scene, the other important considerations are, you know, the time of day, the season, the weather, and any important, you know, visual storytelling needs that need to be thought through from the beginning. You know, and I'm always trying to find ways to instill a little bit more visual poetry into the film. So that's what I've got for you today, and I think there's time for questions, right?
Just one quick question. Looking at the renders that you showed us, I was thinking about, like, you've got a green dinosaur often against green vegetation. How do you make Arlo stand out from the greenery around him?
Well, one thing that helped was because he was kind of simple in his design, so he didn't have as much detail. So that ended up being a great, you know, not, I don't want to say happy accident, because it was designed, but it was a nice feature of his styling. Was that it was fairly easy to pop him out when we needed to, even in a green environment. And his hue was just enough different in color from the vegetation, you know, it was a little fresher green, so that helped too. And also it helps that, you know, we direct the eye where we want the audience to look, which is usually the character. So I think all of that kind of contributes.
Thank you, Sharon.
Thanks, everybody.
You're listening to the Pixar Podcast. That is our episode for today. I hope you enjoyed learning more about Sharon Callahan. We'll be back in 2 weeks. I'm Derek Clements, and talk to you soon. You can now get back to the rest of your life.
Okay, Squirt here will now give you a rundown of proper exiting technique.
Mom, it's just my ball.
Don't let it happen again.
Yes, well, I'll try to be less careless.
It's got this kind of smoky, melty. It's not really a smoky taste. It's a certain, it's kind of like a, you know, it's kind of like this boom zap kind of taste. Don't you think? What would you call that flavor?
Lightning?
Don't look at the light!
I can't help it. It's so beautiful.
My name is Doug. I have just met you, and I love you.
Gone! It's all gone. All of it's gone. Bye-bye. Who's here?
Thank you for listening to the Pixar Podcast.